I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 10:08, Wednesday, February 10th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And today, Bill and I have dueling haircuts. They're both better than the haircuts we had before.
Definitely. You're looking good, Joe. Hey, I want to make a mission that's going to be very hard for me to do, but to prove how old and lame I am. Until Sunday, I had no idea who the Weeknd was. Okay. I told you, you know.
That did it. That was definitely, you proved it right there. That was good. Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable. And it's safe to say that with regard to this show, I have never taken performance enhancing drugs.
We'll find out, John, if you have. Also, I just bought tickets to see the Weeknd next February. So hopefully concerts are back in a year. But yeah.
Is the show on a Saturday or Sunday?
It's on a Saturday. It's on the Weeknd. I'm going to see the Weeknd.
It's on a Weeknd. Okay.
Yep.
Okay. I think that's the only way he'll do it, right?
It's going to be a Weeknd.
There you go. You can't beat that. You can certainly beat the Super Bowl weekend for sure, but you can't beat the Weeknd.
Oh, boy. Oh, don't get me started.
It was so lame. Ugh.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select supports Keeneland's efforts to give back to the thoroughbred industry as profits are reinvested back into the sport through purses, fan development, player rewards, and more. Sign up at KeenelandSelect.com. Spring meet at Keeneland starts April 2nd and runs through April 23rd. So full steam ahead on the Derby Trail. We had three preps over this past weekend. This coming weekend is when the big boys really come to play, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, wanted to get to the Derby preps from this past weekend. There were three major ones, the Withers, the Sam Davis, and the San Vicente. The most highly regarded hyped horse ran in the San Vicente in concert tour to TDN Rising Star. And he, you know, I feel two ways about it. I feel that he, you know, he's a lightly raced horse. This was only his second race. It's hard to judge him too harshly. He still probably has a lot of development to go. He got a 95 buyer, which was the highest of the three preps of the weekend. But visually, I thought that was an extremely disappointing performance. And, you know, I don't want to be too hard on him. And some people have made the comparison to Nadal, who similarly last year had a debut win that was impressive, ran in the San Vicente, I think only won by 3/4 of a length or so. And then obviously went on to be pretty good in the Rebel and the Arkansas Derby. So I wouldn't be surprised if Concert Tour becomes that good. But I don't know, the trip that he got just sitting off of those dueling leaders in third, perched on the outside, I mean, that's the catbird seat in a 7-furlong sprint. And I expected at the top of the stretch him to roll by those horses and kick away. And he was life and death to get up in that race. So yeah, it's a factor perhaps of him being so lightly raced. Joel Rosario is also a rider who is not going to ask everything out of a horse every single time. He's a very confident, I would say sometimes overconfident rider, but he's just one of those guys that's not going to, you know, drive and push everything out of a horse to the wire. So there are mitigating circumstances, but I was expecting a much better performance out of him visually. The other two, Candyman Rocket, who won the Sam Davis, he got the lowest buyer of the three. He got an 85. That was a race where it looked like he was going to kick away at the eighth pole. He really took charge in early stretch, and it looked like he was going to draw off and then flattened out late and ended up winning by about 3/4 of a length. The pace was pretty quick in there, so he had a right to get a little tired, but the horses that ran 1-2-3 around the track, I think ran 1-2-4 or 1-3-4. I think only one horse closed in there, so I wouldn't want too many of those closers coming out of that race. There's a really good story in today's TDN about Frank Fletcher, the owner of Candyman Rocket, by Chris McGraw. It's a great story. You should check it out if you haven't. The horse that I wanted out of the three was Risk Taking, who won the Withers for Chad Brown and Clarvish Stables. He, I thought, really kicked away smartly and strongly in the stretch. He got a pretty good trip, but the way he finished up suggests that 10 furlongs is going to be right up his alley. He ran 151 and change, which to me in the dead of winter at Aqueduct is a pretty damn good time for 9 furlongs. I'm not sure exactly what Byron got. I think he got around a 90. So I think it was in the middle of the other two preps. But of the three going forward to the Derby, he's the one I want. Concert Tour is obviously going to get most of the hype, but I'll stick with Risk Taking out of those three. And then we'll get to see the like I said, the big boys come to play this weekend in the Southwest and the Risen Star. But let's get some thoughts from you guys on this weekend's preps.
Joe, I sort of agree with you about the Baffert Horse Concert Tour and sort of don't agree with you. Yes, I mean, especially with Baffert, the bar is set so high. You know, you think every one of these things is going to win by 5 lengths, you know, eased up under the wire. But I think one thing you might be overlooking is maybe the horse that ran second is really good too, Freedom Fighter. And that's another Baffert horse. I mean, he didn't have the kind of sexy buyer number coming into this race that Concert Tour did. But remember, virtually the same thing happened with Life Is Good in the Sham Stakes. It was like, oh my goodness, he was life and death to beat this horse, Medina Spirit. Who's Medina Spirit? And then Medina Spirit came back and showed what he's really all about. So, you know, I'm not saying that I would pick this horse to win the Derby at this point, but I think we got to see at least one more from him. You know, he's at least a contender for the Derby. Is he a, you know, Baffert's big gun? Is he one of the top five contenders? I think that's something that we still have to see. So far as the other two races, the Sam Davis and the Withers, you know, there's all, you have a question of what was the quality in those races. You know, the horses that won did look good, but, you know, exactly in sort of, you know, B-level Derby preps like that or C-level Derby preps, who were they running against and what kind of the quality is. But I think the story out of both of them is the trainers. You know, Bill Mott does have a Kentucky Derby win, but it has an asterisk next to it. And I'm sure he would love to win the Kentucky Derby without having to be put first through disqualification. And he's not a guy who normally has Derby horses. And he runs 1-2 in the Sam F. Davis with Candyman Rocket over the other horse. And then the same with Chad Brown. You know, Chad Brown could pop up on the trail of the Triple Crown here and there, but for the most part, you know, he's not really been a player, and he has risk-taking. You know, he's risk-taking the kind of horse that can get him all the way and, you know, at the very least be a major presence on the road to the Kentucky Derby. And, you know, look, Chad Brown can, you know, win all the Flower Bowls and Sheep's Head Bays of the world, but I'm sure deep down he would obviously love to get a Kentucky Derby win. So keep an eye on those horses and the trainers.
And this is what makes horse racing such a fun sport, is that there's three of us who are quote unquote experts. And we all looked at the three races through very different lenses. Concert Tour, as an owner, I look at Concert Tour, for example, and I say he won first time out going 3/4. Then they stepped them up about 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks later, very short window, and ran him back going 7/8. And he came off the pace and won. And I think, you know, Bill, to your point, if you took Baffert's name off the trainer line and put somebody else's name on the trainer line, you would say, oh, okay, they're doing it the right way. They're gradually, you know, increasing the distance. They're gradually increasing the competition. And that's what's going to make the horse have, you know, learn how to run off the pace, learn how to be a better racehorse than just a gate to wire horse that can't really do that for, you know, for the bigger races, for the Derby and the Preakness, et cetera. And this is a horse that is gradually, you know, earning his stripes as he goes through the preps and gets ultimately to the Kentucky Derby. So I look at it as Concert Tour, you know, with a 94-95 buyer, you know, did it the right way. He probably should have bounced based on the fact that he ran his first start just a couple of weeks prior to that. And now they were trying to, you know, stretch him out and improve him up to a grade two. The next race for me for Concert Tour is going to be the litmus test. That's going to be whether or not we're going to know if he's a pretender or a contender, quite frankly. So I really like Concert Tour. I thought he ran a good race, and I'm looking forward to his next spot, especially coming off, you know, the back-to-back quick races like that. Joe, I agree with you that Risk-Taking was really impressive, on that frozen racetrack up at Aqueduct in the wintertime. To go 9 furlongs already, which is one of the furthest preps at this point in time that they offer, and took on a field of 9 horses and, you know, did it the right way, sat off the pace, made a big run. And, you know, Eric Council right now is quietly taking over the leading rider spot at Aqueduct. I mean, he has surpassed a lot of his, you know, fellow jockeys, Franco, Davis, et cetera, and is winning at a high clip and is riding with a lot of confidence right now. So it's nice to see that he has, you know, a nice horse like Risk-Taking, you know, going into the other Derby preps coming up. Candyman Rocket was an interesting race, as you mentioned. Again, a full field, ran a really impressive race. But the thing that I took away from that race wasn't even the winner or the second place horse, the fact that they're both trained by Bill Mott. It was Known Agenda. Known Agenda basically gave the field so much. I mean, you know, 10, 15 lengths before he kicked it into gear and started making a huge run at the end. And I think that as the races get longer, Known Agenda is going to be a horse that hopefully we'll be talking about, you know, as he develops and grows. It was a tough ask to have him go from New York all the way to Florida and run in that kind of a race. And I know he was the beaten favorite and a lot of people write him off because of that, but that wasn't his best day. That was not his best race in my humble opinion. So I was really pleased to see that. And also let's give props to Nova Rags, who was coming off, you know, he came off a minor layoff after running, you know, an okay race in the Nashua, won the Pasco. And then he ran a good solid second in the race to Candyman Rocket. And again, going from 7 furlongs to a mile 16th, that's a big ask for a horse. So there were a couple of horses in here that I think are sneaky and under the radar that we'll be talking about. And, you know, overall, though, this is when the rubbers meet in the road or in races like these.
Yeah, it's an interesting point about trainers because, you know, where is if John likes Known Agenda, he's the Pletcher horse, right?
No, Known Agenda's the Chad Brown horse.
Chad Brown. I was going to say, like, where is the big Todd Pletcher horse on the Derby Trail? I mean, maybe I'm forgetting somebody. He had Muta Sabek when the Mucho Macho Man, and then he promptly got injured and is going to miss the Derby Trail.
Right. I thought it was Known Agenda. Known Agenda was the Pletcher horse that was the favorite that ran so
fast. That's what I said.
Yeah. Oh, no. Yeah. I thought you said risk taking.
No. Oh, maybe. I meant Known Agenda. Yeah. So he maybe he's the one, but, you know, I feel like usually around this time, at least, you know, Todd's got 2, 3, 4 major contenders for the Derby. And I don't really see anybody after, you know, Prime Factor. Maybe he can bounce back after the Holy Bowl, but. You know, it's a changing of the guard a little bit because, you know, Pletcher usually has this stable of monster 3-year-olds. And so far that doesn't seem to be the case. Bob Baffert's got it cornered. It seems so far he's running 1-2 in every prep in California, including the San Vicente over the weekend. But before we move on from this past weekend's races, I wanted to mention the greatest hype horse of all time who didn't show up at all. On Sunday at Santa Anita, who was a horse named Bezos, who's an unraced horse for Bob Baffert, who had enough buzz to even be listed as an individual interest in the Derby future wager, which you never see that. You never see horses who haven't even at least run once be listed as an individual betting interest there. And he was, and people bet him and he was 26-1 at the closing of the last Derby future wager, which is just staggering to me first of all, I think future wagers in general are a bad bet because most times you're going to get a better price on Derby day than you do in the future wager. And so many things have to happen between the future wager and the Derby for your horse to even get in the gate. So there are so many built-in obstacles to even have action on the day of the race. Now, saying that, the Derby winner is going to run this weekend, and I didn't get him at 34-1 in the future wager. So I'm going to overbet this Saturday on my horse, but we'll get to that in a little bit. But so he ran on Sunday, was a total no-show. The horse who won the race, Dreamshake, was another interesting case where the horse was 20-1 and won like a 3-5 shot. If you had just watched that race and didn't know who the horses were, you would have assumed the winner was Bezos and Dreamshake was the one who ran up the track. But Dreamshake, who was named after, I assume, Hakeem Olajuwon's famous move. Great, great name for a horse right there. If we could get like a gif of Hakeem doing the Dreamshake, that might be a little too much to ask. But he was super impressive. But the story of the race was Bezos. And I just wonder how these horses get so much hype. Because if you looked at the clocker report for that day, it wasn't a huge, you know, A-, B-plus littered clocker report page for Bezos. It was like some decent works. He was second best to Fenway, who stunk it up a week or two ago. So I wonder how this happens. Like, how does the word get around so much that the horse is included in the Derby future wager pool and takes real action in it and then stinks it up like that? You know, it's obviously only one race. Maybe the horse will end up being good. But it just, this was one of the horses where the hype seemed to overwhelm everything about the horse substantively. But I know Bill has some thoughts on this.
Well, yeah, I mean, first, let's give some numbers here. He was beaten 15 and a quarter lengths, finished seventh. And also, I mean, you're so used to Baffert just never doing anything wrong. He ran a second horse in the race, Tivoli Toro, didn't take a whole lot of money. I think it was about 6-1. That horse was last, beaten 26 and a half lengths. Joe, I literally have never seen anything hyped to this degree. People writing stories about the horse coming in, like it was an advance for the Santa Anita Derby. You know, Bezos to make debut. But I think this is kind of like what we've gotten to now. And I think Justify kind of accelerated the situation. Everybody wants to be the first to know something. You know, I want to be the smart guy who knew back in, you know, before he was born that Bezos was going to be the greatest horse ever. And, you know, so you get that. You get the hype with Baffert being involved. As you think, some of the people that talked to Baffert, you said the clock report wasn't, you know, off the charts good. Baffert never even said anything to the effect of like really special horse. He just kind of said, you know, he's good. I think he'll run okay. You know, I think that is. And then it was just a snowball effect. I mean, the first guy out there said, oh, my God, did you hear about this Baffert horse? And then he told five friends, and they told five friends. Then they ran to Vegas to bet on him at 50-1, and then they went to, you know, the future book. You know, there's some chance that the horse had some sort of problem in the race. I can't believe that with all this hype, that's the real horse. You know, he may not be a Triple Crown winner, but, you know, if he's – you know, able to bounce back. I think we'll see more and hear more from this horse down the road. But for right now, yeah, I'm glad I'm not holding any of those Derby future wager tickets out of a 26-1. You wouldn't have them at 2,600-1 right now.
Right, right. And you know, because of the hype, I actually had written a haiku about Bezos winning the Breeders' Cup and winning the Kentucky Derby. So I'm going to have to throw that one away. No, I'm not going to read it now because now it's moot. It doesn't make sense. But as far as not to beat that one,
all your beautiful poetry from the world, John, that's not fair.
I know. You know what? I will. At some point, I'll be confident enough and comfortable enough in my own skin to actually let the world hear my sonnets and haikus. But that's for another day. But my other takeaway from the weekend of racing was actually, if we can extend the weekend to Monday because of the snow up here, was Miss Brazil in the Ruthless. What a phenomenal race. And I know only three horses entered the race. All right. There's only five altogether. Three actually ran and only two of them finished. So, you know, so you really, you say, all right, what were they running against? But Miss Brazil, you know, went out there in the Ruthless going 7/8, 23-1, 46-1, 111 flat, and was really just running all by herself. She was 7 lengths up on the next horse and they were like 20 something race lengths up on the third place horse. So actually, unfortunately, didn't finish. How about having a 3-year-old filly in the Ruthless? You get scratched down to a 3-horse field and you're like, all I got to do is finish and I get black type. This filly gets stakes placed and she doesn't finish the race. That's like going to be the ultimate insult. And I feel bad for the owners. To me, that was an impressive race. And then Moonlit D'Oro, who I know now has they announced that after winning, she has a chip and isn't going to, you know, run in the Oaks. But she ran a monster race out in Santa Anita as well, winning with an 85 buyer, a Medaglia, you know, D'Oro filly out of a Bernardini mare. And, you know, again, another impressive race. But unfortunately, the racing gods decided that she needed a break after that win. But that was actually a pretty cool race and win to watch as well. And my last comment, and I know I'm going to sound like the old man that Bill, when Bill started off the show of I'm an old man, I didn't even know who the weekend is. I'm going to sound like an old man now because I'm going to say, how awesome is it that the old guard stallions are doing so well? You have Medaglia Philly winning a grade two. You have Candy Ride winning the Sammy Davis, another Medaglia winning the Withers, and then finally Street Sense winning the San Vicente, and all out of, you know, Bernardini Forestry and Distorted Humor mares to boot. So yay for the old guard.
We love old guys on the show, as evidenced by 2/3 of our panel being old guys. There are a couple other.
Two-thirds. Who's the other one, Joe? How old are you? Are you 30 yet?
Just barely. I just turned 34, man. I'm catching up to you guys.
Wow, you're gonna lap us pretty soon. Oh my gosh.
just a couple other things from the past weekend. You mentioned Moonlit D'Oro. At Santa Anita, also there was a horse who apparently the entire universe knew was gonna win, except me. Hit the Road in the Thunder Road Stakes, who was on paper I think probably like 35-1 and was 3-1 in the race and won off by like 5 or 6 lengths. Got a 99 buyer, so he's certainly an interesting horse in the turf miler division going forward. I wish I'd gotten the tip because that killed my pick six. Thing paid like 24 grand. Anyway,
I saw you tweeted about how does everyone know
this someone horse? Tell me how that horse was 3-1 on paper in that race. Please, yep. Someone hit the hotline. Call me.
Exactly. Bill, a tweet is when you announce something on the internet and other people read it. I don't want you to feel, you know, that you're out of the loop here.
That's the weekend.
Only on the weekend, right?
but elsewhere, Get Smoking won the Tampa Bay Stakes. Shout out to Get Stormy, man. He's an underrated sire. You want to talk about a horse that stands for a reasonable price at a smaller farm? It sounds like I'm doing a commercial for Crestwood here, but just observationally, he does a really great job with, I think, limited opportunities. And just to wrap up the Bezos discussion, the other horse in the race that Bill said was 6-1. You might as well be 60-1 if you're a Bob Baffert horse and you're 6-1. And you know, it was kind of ironic because it was the same week that Jeff Bezos stepped down as the CEO of Amazon. So some interesting symmetry there. But Bill makes a good point that Bob Baffert himself never was like, oh my God, this horse is the greatest thing in the world. It's just, it went off, you know, it took off on its own volition, I guess, to have that kind of hype train. And I want to get in the head of somebody who bets a future wager on a horse who has never started before in the Derby. I want to get in that person's head and then maybe rearrange a couple of wires. Solid weekend of racing, but this weekend coming up, I think I'm gonna segue seamlessly into this weekend's preview because we got a lot of big horses running this weekend, namely big 3-year-olds. Although I think we're gonna see Monomoy Girl in the Bayakoa Stakes at Oaklawn, so it'll be nice to see her start her campaign early on in the season. Last year, obviously coming off of the injury, she didn't run until late May and only ran 4 times. Total on the year, which, you know, I lamented her being a horse of the year finalist, blah, blah, blah. She didn't win. But this year, hopefully she stays healthy. I think we're going to get a full campaign for Monomoy Girl. And I think we're going to get some outside the box spots for her. I think the Bayako is a nice soft beginning spot, but I would assume she's going to run against the boys. She's going to run in some big races. Maybe she even goes overseas to tackle the Dubai World Cup. That's just what I would like to see. I don't have any information on that whatsoever. But we have two major 3-year-old preps, one on Saturday, one on Monday, which is President's Day at Oaklawn. Saturday, we have the Risen Star, which is the middle prep for the Kentucky Derby on the Fairgrounds Trail. Obviously, Louisiana Derby is the closer out over there. My Derby horse that I've been pumping up for a while, Senior Buscador, is going to be in there. He's 6-1 morning line. Hope I get that, you know, because like I said, I'm going to have to overbet because I didn't get him at 34-1. See, I have this figured out in my mind now that if I'm going to overbet him on Saturday, hopefully I get 4 or 5-1 at least. If he doesn't win, then I'm still going to, because there's another future wager this weekend that closes Sunday. If he doesn't win, then I'll get my price on him on Sunday in the future wager. If he does win, I'm still going to parlay that money into the reduced future price. So this is what happens. This is the mind of a bettor that when you miss out on an opportunity.
Of a degenerate gambler, yes.
Okay, all right, Jack. All right. I had a DJ Stable horse at 25-1 on Sunday. So
you were the only one.
Thanks for that. Apparently I was the only one, unlike Hit the Road. This is my plan after missing out on him at 34-1 in the Derby future wager. But he is, I think, super, super impressive. He's only run twice. Both times has been a dominant winner despite missing the break. He clearly wants to go 2 turns. He's by mine shaft. He's going to get to stretch out to 1.8 miles after running a mile at Remington last out. So I don't want to talk about too much. Not that we have this much sway, but I don't want to depress his price anymore. But it looks like a really good, really big field in there. You're going to have, I think, the top couple from the LeCompte in there, Midnight Bourbon, Mandaloon. Proxy is also going to run. He ran in the LeCompte. So it looks like a big quality field in the Risen Star. It looks like another big field in the Rachel Alexandra as well. Super sensational for Mark Cassie and Live Oak. It's a really nice looking filly. She's going to run in there. Travel Column, who was really impressive in winning the Goldenrod for Brad Cox and OXO. I think she's going to run in that race too. Charlie's Penny, who won the Silver Bullet Day. So it looks like a really good quality day of racing coming up at Fairgrounds on Saturday with big fields. We also have Maxfield. Maxfield's going to run in the mine shaft. So we've been waiting a long time to see Max Field string races together. Looks like it's going to happen this weekend. So we'll be very intrigued to see the way he runs. So it looks like a really good card Saturday at Fairgrounds. And then you're probably going to have a much shorter field in the Southwest on Monday at Oaklawn, but you're going to have a big rematch and the three-year-old debut of Essential Quality, who was, you know, couldn't really ask him to do much more than he did in three starts as a two-year-old. He's obviously the leading contender. I believe he's the shortest price of any of the Derby future wager individual interest, unless there's another unraced Bob Baffert horse that people are taking plunges on. But he's going to make his three-year-old debut, and he's going to face off against Jackie's Warrior. Now, they clash in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, and Essential Quality got the best of Jackie's Warrior. But the dynamics of that race led to, I think, the discrepancy between where they finished. I think Jackie's Warrior was up on that quick pace. Essential Quality got to sit and make one run. Looks like it's going to be a short field. Jackie's Warrior might have an easier time of it on the lead. There's going to be a real question for him going forward of whether or not he wants to go two turns. I think it's inconclusive so far, because I think he did run pretty well in the juvenile considering the circumstances. But we're going to get a really nice rematch, a really nice early season clash. And I think we're all looking forward to seeing Essential Quality, especially run in the Southwest. I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts on the upcoming preps.
Joe, I can see why you like Senor Buscador. You know, you don't think a horse coming out of the Springboard Mile at Remington would necessarily go on to be a major Kentucky Derby contender. But, you know, you look at that big 93 buyer number going a mile for the first time, and then the kind of trip this horse got. It was 10th early. The pace was not that fast and really closed very well. And, you know, I always get a kick out of having guys like Todd Fincher, the trainer, being on the Kentucky Derby trail. You know, we love Bob Baffert and Todd Fletcher, but after a while, it gets a little tiring to see the same old faces every year. I'll let John tackle the Southwest if he wants. The only other horse in the Risen Star that you didn't mention is, you know, Keep Me in Mind. He's got the 12 post. I assume he'll be the favorite, even though he only ran an 80 in the Kentucky Jockey Club. But he was third in the Breeders' Cup behind Essential Quality. Came back and won the Grade 2 at Churchill. And it's interesting to see Diodoro have a Derby horse. I mean, this is a guy who's claim to fame is winning, you know, $5,000 claimers at Turf Paradise every day. And, you know, he's obviously trying to move up in the leagues of the big boys. So Keep Me in Mind is the likely favorite in there. But Joe, I'm not going to, you know, I have no such plans about, you know, the Derby future wager and how much I should bet now and all that. But I'll be rooting for you. I think this horse looks pretty darn good.
And overall, it's just a really fun, great, deep program of races at the fairgrounds. You know, going through it, it was like, oh, this is an interesting race. Oh, this is an interesting race. And there's stake races, there's allowance races, there's maiden special weight races where literally half the, it was such a big field that they had to split it. And half of each field are Derby nominated horses as well. So there's a lot of intrigue with regard to Saturday's card at the fairgrounds. You guys mentioned a lot of the horses that I was going to talk about. You know, I'm specifically looking at Proxy to see how he does and see how he continues to lengthen out and go further on his campaign. But there's, you know, 6-7 horses in that race that you can point to and look back at. I think, you know, a month and a half from now, we're going to look back at this race as kind of a key race and say, oh yeah, that's where so-and-so really, you know, earned his stripes, or that's where so-and-so got a tough break and then ran a sneaky good race and now is running in the Wood or the, you know, or the Toyota Bluegrass or something like that. Something that's not on, you know, on public display right now is the fact that it, you know, Mark Hasse has 8 horses on Saturday's card at Fairgrounds, ranging from, like I said, made special weight races to allowance races to stake races. But it's also, if you believe in synergy and kismet, it's also his 60th birthday this weekend. And he is actually going to attend the Fairgrounds because he's got 8 horses and his son Norm has 5 horses and they only overlap, I think, in one race. So he's got a lot of rooting interest for Team Cassie and Family Cassie. And a couple of them are with ours. You had mentioned West Point's, you know, representation in one of the stake races. We actually own Turned Aside with West, you know, with our friends over at West Point and going to run in the Colonel Power. And it could be a really interesting race. And I'm looking forward to it, even though I may not bet on any of the races. I'm looking forward to watching the races and see how it develops, because there may be other Derby horses that come out of these maiden races and or the allowance race that show up on our radar down the road.
And before we move on from this weekend preview, which again, I think it's going to be a terrific, terrific weekend of racing, holiday weekend, which is always fun because you get 3 days usually of big stakes races instead of two. But just before we move on, the friend of the show, West Point, is going to have Hard Not to Love in the Santa Monica and Santa Anita. She's going to go. She won the Santa Monica last year, so she's going for back to back wins in the Santa Monica. I also wanted to mention Wells Bayou, who's coming back in the Razorback at Oakland. We haven't seen much of him since he won the Louisiana Derby last year. And one of the horses I wanted to mention in the Gulfstream Park Sprint Stakes this Saturday is Mischievous Alex, who won the Swale last year by a million lengths, and then kind of fell off the rest of the year, came back, ran a big, big race in his comeback race in allowance at Gulfstream. I think got a 103 by one geared down. And one of the horses, I forget the name, but one of the horses who ran behind him that day came back and won by a bunch the other day at Gulfstream. So he's going to be, I think, in a short field in the Gulfstream Park Sprint, but I think he has a chance to be a really, really good sprinter this year. So that's another horse that I'll be looking forward to, but there'll be plenty to talk about next weekend, and good luck to everybody who's getting involved, not just me trying to get back on Senior Buscador. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say, the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love, running this Saturday in the Santa Monica, and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse like Hard Not to Love. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. Good luck to all the partners this Saturday in Santa Monica. So this was reported last week on Steve Bick's show, on his radio show. He talked to Patrick McKenna, who's one of the higher ups at NYRA, about them restricting computer assisted wagering. And Bill wrote on it about it in his Week in Review, and he's been a voice on this as well. And it's such a big deal because this is the kind of this computer assisted wagering. I'm sure most of you know. If you don't know, groups of people with a huge amount of money to bet. And they have all sorts of algorithms and stuff that basically make all the wagering decisions for them. And their programs are able to analyze real-time odds data, basically down to the second before the last gate closes. And that's why you see these big odds shifts in horses, and where a horse goes off at 3-1 and then the middle of the race goes down to 8-5. And it's a source of unending frustration for horse players. You know, I had this past, last week I tweeted about it, but I bet a late double at Gulfstream. I liked the horse in the finale. I forget which day it was, Wednesday or Thursday. So I hit the late double, thankfully. I hit it. So it was okay somewhat, but when the race went off, I was looking at the probables for the double. It was a $68 double for $2. Into half mile into the race, the probable goes down to $47. $68 to $47. That's like the value of the bet, of the winning bet, was cut by almost 33% after the race went off. So this is the stuff that frustrates me to no end, and a lot of horse players to no end, that this kind of stuff happens. It's just, it makes you feel like a loser even when you win. And there's no other gambling game where you bet something and then you get a different payout than the one you were expecting when the event went off. Anyway, the story is that NYRA is now restricting or banning those computer assisted wagering programs in the Empire Six and the Pick Five pools. Which, great, great, great job by NYRA. I got to give a major hat tip to NYRA, because no one else, as far as I know, at least, has even broached this topic and has even talked about, you know, restricting these wagering groups. The Thurbit Idea Foundation and Pat Cummings have been beating this drum for a while, and I haven't seen anybody else, anybody, you know, institutionally in the sport address this. So shout out to Naira for that, first of all. But I will say, those aren't the pools that I think of as being drastically affected by computer wagering. You know, there's hardly ever a time where I hit a pick five or pick six and I'm like, damn, this payout is so much lower than I was expecting. Because there are so many combinations, I think that their effect is diluted in the pick five and the pick six pools, because there are just so many different permutations that it's so much harder for them to just crush a certain combination as opposed to win bets and doubles and exactas. Like, those are the pools where you really need to weed this stuff out. And it's not an easy thing. It's a hard conversation, because like Bill made the point in the Week in Review, and I'm sure he's going to make it again, that this is, you know, racing needs this handle. They need the $1 billion in handle that these guys contribute every year. So it's a catch 22. You don't want to ban them and lose handle when you're, you know, just barely scraping by as a sport as it is, but you also don't want to turn off all of the regular horse players who are getting screwed by these guys. So it's a difficult conversation. I'm going to toss it over to Bill to see what he has to say, but I think we're both going to have a lot of thoughts on this.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is a huge problem for horse racing and something that is largely flying under the radar. You know, this thing that Naira did bring it to the surface, but the you know, you don't hear anything about it. These guys operate in complete secrecy. No one will ever tell you who they are, how much they're betting, how much they win, that sort of thing. So there's two problems, and the one you already mentioned, you know, I totally agree. You know, the horse goes into the gate at 6-1, you make your bet, and then half mile into the race, the horse is 3-1. I mean, imagine if halfway into the Super Bowl, they said to you, Tampa Bay's doing a lot better than we thought, so the spread is no more 3.5. Now Tampa Bay's 7-point favorite. Huh? You know, what are you talking about? I mean, it's essentially the same sort of thing. But I think the bigger issue, and you touched on this as well, is, you know, you have whales. You have guys betting, my estimation, and this is a lot of guessing, is that they bet at least $3 billion a year on horse racing, which would account for about 35% of all handle in horse racing. And I'm told by some people that estimate is probably too low. Look, they deserve to do well because they're smart, they're good. I couldn't write these computer programs. I wouldn't have a prayer to do something like that. So, you know, they are being rewarded for, you know, being able to do things right, do things well, handicap well, have the computer programs, have the kind of money. But they're going to drive everybody else out of the sport. The little guys like you, me, that might be betting $20 a race, $50 a race, $10 a race, we're getting killed. The money they're making comes from somewhere. It's not from the house. It's coming from the pockets of the everyday horse player. And again, I'd love to be able to see numbers on this, and no one will ever give it to you. But if they dominate a pool, say they dominate an exact or your daily double pool, like you were talking about, and you know they take home the bulk of the money, you're now looking at some of these bets, in effect, might have a 40-45% takeout when you factor in the money bet by these guys. So it's not going to happen overnight, but you're going to see more and more people, the regular guys, get out of the game. You just can't get pounded. They can't tap you out. At some point in time, you have no more money left. You know, you're going to go play bingo at the church instead of betting on horses. But as you said, horse racing is in no position whatsoever to tell these guys, bye-bye, see ya. They can't do away with one-third of their handle. So there's no answer to this, none whatsoever. You know, Naira did something that is helpful, but, you know, they're still betting in all the other pools, which probably make up 95% of all wagered in Naira, something like that. And they're still affecting the double pool, the exacta pool, the trifecta pool, the win pool, et cetera. You know, this is something, I don't have the answer to this, but this is a big deal, and it's only going to continue to get worse.
And Joe, you probably follow this much more than I do, but with regard to some of the handicapping contests also, you know, even the big ones that are out in Vegas at the end of the year, have there been, you know, guys who utilize this, you know, computer program opportunities to do well in pools like that or win championships?
I don't think so. I don't think there you can have that kind of automated system in contests. I don't know that for a fact, but I think you have to you have to make all of your wagers through a certain cashier or a certain interface or whatever. I don't think that it can be affected in that way. And also you're limited, you know, by your budget and something like that. It's like Bill said, there's no easy answer. I mean, conditional wagering is one way to kind of combat it, where you put in a bet and the bet only goes live if the horse ends up at a certain price. But then that has its issues as well. But yeah, it's a tough thing, because like Bill said, there's no illegality going on here. There's nothing like, you know, we got to bust these guys and you know, make them pay, because they're not doing anything wrong. It's just it sucks all of the fun, not all of the fun, but a lot of the fun out of the game for a regular horse player, because it is hard as hell to be a regular middle class horse player. There are so many hurdles you got to jump through, you know, high takeout rates, arbitrary DQs. Like just picking horses in general is a very, very hard thing to do, as I can tell you, as any horse player can tell you. So it's, I don't know, there's no easy answer, but you're gonna drain a lot of, you know, meat and potatoes people. You're gonna drain them and push them out of the business if this stuff continues. And you know, I give a shout out to Naira for at least, you know, trying to start to address this issue. Those aren't the pools where these guys are really dominating, really affecting the payouts after the race goes off. Yeah, I don't know. Some people have suggested like cutting off bets earlier on, but that's just going to be the same thing. It's just going to be a minute earlier. If you cut off the bets a minute to post, you know, you're still going to see that late odds drop, and you're not going to be able to do anything about it. You know, maybe give you know, people under a certain handle amount a chance to cancel their wagers after seeing, you know, what the final odds are. I don't know. There has to be some kind of solution somewhere, but I don't know. Maybe I'm not smart enough to think about it off the top of my head, but this is something that's a vexing problem for horse racing and for horse bettors. And, you know, I give a lot of credit actually to Pat Cummings and the TIF for bringing this issue to the forefront, because it's something that, you know, other than Bill, I didn't see a lot of people talking about it for a while. And it sucks for regular horse players. And, you know, even though I hit that double last week, I felt like, you know, I got screwed. Like I still probably would have played it, but I didn't have the opportunity to make the decision not to play it at a much reduced payout. So there's so many hoops you got to jump through to be a successful horse player to begin with. And this is just making it harder for people. And they're not doing anything wrong, but it's frustrating. It's frustrating as a horse player to feel so helpless and to feel at the whim of these guys. It reminds me a little bit of what happened, you know, with Wall Street and GameStop and everything. And you know, the Reddit users getting, you know, pumping up and doing the short squeeze on GameStop. And it was just even more than like anybody who actually made money off that. I'm sure there were a lot of people who did make good money off of that. I think it was more of an airing of frustration that this game is rigged against us. Wall Street and all of these short selling and trading practices are rigged against us. We don't know. We don't have the insider knowledge to win this game. And you know, this is our way of fighting back. We're gonna buy up something some worthless stock that, you know, meant a lot to us in our youth, and we're gonna make them pay. And that's why there were so many people, you know, people all across the aisle were so, you know, enthused and excited about that, from left to right, to see someone finally sticking it to these hedge funds. And it's not quite the same scale, but that kind of reminds me of what we're dealing with now with these computer wagering programs, because you just feel like the game is rigged against you, and these guys are going to have an edge on you, and they're going to reduce your bottom line as a regular horse player. And that's no good for the, like I said, the meat and potatoes, middle class horse players that this game desperately needs to stick around. And hopefully there can be some kind of solution thought of in the future, but it's not going to be easy, because it's a tricky issue for sure. All right, so we wanted to have these numbers last week. They came out the day after we recorded, but we have the January handle numbers. The economic indicators from Equibase, and we, you know, this was one of the stories we talked about on our year-end show that we wanted to watch in 2021. You know, whether or not these positive handle trends would continue, and at least for 1 month, they have. You know, this is something that we're going to have to keep monitoring and you know, watch for at least a quarter or half of the year just to get like any definitive proof. But it seems to me, at least, I guess I'm the chief optimist on this one, that racing did pick up new customers in 2020. And Bill did a story about it. It was really good. You should check out where he talked to guys from DraftKings or FanDuel, excuse me, the FanDuel Racing Sportsbook. And, you know, they talked about their new signups, and they said that people are still betting. People that, you know, signed up during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, when there were no other sports going on, they didn't just sign up then, place a couple bets, and then leave. They're still betting. So, you know, that's anecdotal. Obviously, we don't have any hard data on how many new customers racing picked up, but what we do have is the handle numbers. And we were, I think, shocked, pleasantly surprised that handle was basically flat in 2020, considering all the circumstances, considering fewer races, considering the pandemic and the economy being in the tank. So now we have a month of data from 2021, and I'll read it to you. $959 million, $959,602,269 was bet on U.S. races in January, compared to a little over $875 million last year. So that's a big jump. That's 9.57% increase. And this is despite a 6% decrease in races. There were 2,211 races in January this year, compared to 2,352 last year. So if you average that out, average wagering per race day, it was up 21.6%. $3,763,146 to $3,094,579. 21.6% jump in wagering per race day in January. Field size was also up slightly to over 8, which is like we could ever have an average field size in America of 8 or 9 horses. Is just, you know, a brand new world. But, you know, this is something you have to look at this in the context of wagering on racing was declining every single year, basically for the past almost 20 years, I believe, since like the early 2000s was the last time wagering increased year over year. And now we have flat wagering like last year, which to me, if you factor in, you know, all the circumstances, that's to me is a increase in wagering. Now we have a month of data from 2021 and a massive jump in wagering per race day. Now, I'm sure there are people who will have reasons to believe that this is a little bit illusory and it's going to come back down to earth. But, you know, I choose to be the optimist because there was such a negative trend for so long that, you know, this is something to hold on to. This is something to grasp onto, some good news in racing, and something that is incredibly difficult to do, to get new customers to bet on our sport. We've been trying it for decades, and it's been failure after failure after failure. And now it seems that at least the circumstances of 2020 put us in the spotlight through, you know, we didn't do anything to deserve that spotlight. We just happened to be the only sport that was still running at the time. And this is, we are reaping the benefits of that. And like I said, I've said this before, but I got to give a shout out to America's Day at the Races and Naira and, you know, Patty's crew and everybody who works on that show. It was so, so important to have that presence on national television every single day when people were starving, were dying for something to watch and bet on. That was so, so crucial. And that's something that didn't exist a couple of years ago, that daily show, that daily national show. You know, they used to have Saratoga Live and Belmont Live, but that was just on MSG. That was just on local networks. Thankfully, Fox Sports picked it up and brought it to a larger audience, and everybody there did a great job. But, you know, it's hard for me as someone who is, you know, leans more towards pessimism when it comes to racing issues. It's hard for me to be pessimistic about this kind of jump in wagering. We need more data, but so far, so good since the pandemic hit. Would you guys agree?
Yeah, Joe, by and large, I do agree. And also, this was the second straight month that they had some pretty good numbers come out. In December, they were up 6.34%. So we kind of talked about this before. None of this is bad news. That's obvious. Couldn't possibly be bad news. But I still think, you know, we were saying, well, what's going to happen in 2021? And we're all eager to get these first numbers in. They came in, they look good. But I still think, you know, we need to take a deep breath and still wait for a little bit more data to come in, as you mentioned it. And there's a couple things, and Alex Waldrop, the NTRA, pointed this out to me, I didn't even think about it, was that in January of 2021, there were 5 weekends. The weekend, there you go, our man, the weekend, versus 4 in January 2020. And that makes a big difference because the handle on a Saturday and Sunday is going to be a lot bigger than otherwise. And then the other thing too, and it's going to go back to a subject someone else pointed out to me, and they don't know this for a fact, but said, all, you know, you get a press release from a track at the end of the meet and they're crowing about our handle was up 14% or something like that. And said, you know what? More often than not, that's because the computer guys were betting more money. That they what changed their rebate from 9.3% to 9.5%. And then they, so they, you know, come in and instead of betting $15 million on Saratoga, they bet $25 million on Saratoga. Is that have something to do with why these numbers are up? I have no idea, but you have to keep that in mind. I mean, they control everything now. It's their world and the rest of us are just living into it. But you know, when we get the numbers for January, February, March, the first quarter of 2021, we'll have a pretty good idea. I think it's likely that racing did pick up some customers, but still, you know, more to be told that we haven't heard the full story yet.
Yeah, and really, all it took was a historic pandemic for the industry to set itself up to be in a good spot. I mean, go figure, right? But yeah, the numbers were good. I'm happy. Believe me, as somebody who enjoys the horse industry as much as I do, I'm very pleased to see that handle is up because that money is going to flow through all the different aspects of the industry, and that's going to make it a better, stronger industry. I think one of the things that that we haven't brought up yet is the fact that, you know, because of the pandemic or because of political pressures or just because people are fed up and or a combination of all of the above, the industry itself is starting to move in the right direction as far as making sure that horses get, you know, sounder, that the industry is better, that the you know, that horses that are injured or infirmed aren't going back to the races early. They have to go through certain protocols. You know, racetracks are starting to look back at their safety protocols, you know, for on the racetrack. They're looking at their own racetracks themselves to see if they can make them stronger or better or safer. Same thing with turf courses. And I think all of these little incremental things are all adding up to the product being better. And also, one of the things that Jockey Club Roundtable, you know, came out with a couple of years ago in 2018, when they came out with their study, one of the glaring issues was that the public just didn't have any confidence in the industry. They didn't have any confidence in the horses' soundness and the people that were training or, you know, or taking care of the horses, that the racetracks were doing the right thing. All those issues, you know, led to this deterioration of confidence. Now we're starting to build back confidence into people. And I think the general public is really starting to see that. And that's a wonderful thing. So the numbers are going up, which is great. But I think it's a real byproduct of the fact that the industry said, through a lot of different reasons, we have to get better. We have to be better. We have to have horses sounder. We have to have people that are taking care of them, toe the line better. Are all of them doing it? No, I'm not going to say that all of them are doing it. But the bottom line is that people are really starting to recognize that we're moving in the right direction. And therefore, the money's going to follow it. And that was something that was pointed out a couple of years ago. And kudos to all the powers that be that are moving the industry in that direction to make sure that the product is a better product and better, that people have more confidence in, because then the money will follow.
Bill took the air out of my sails with that. It might just be the computer guys betting more. I spent 20 minutes railing about these guys, and now they're the reason the handle's up. I don't think that's the case. I maybe they're betting a little bit more, but I think this kind of sustained positive handle trend, you know, I think has to do with a lot of regular bettors as well. And that's a good point by John that, you know, if you think about it, this is, you know, we obviously haven't done all the work yet, but this is a remarkable turnaround from just 2 years ago, from just 2019, when we started the podcast and we were like, is there going to be a sport in 5-10 years? Like, if this stuff at Santa Anita continues, like, it was, we were in an existential crisis with the breakdowns at Santa Anita and a huge PR crisis. And, you know, here, just 2 short years later, I don't think we should take all the credit for starting this podcast and getting racing turned around, but I think it's a little too much of a coincidence that we started this podcast and now racing seems to be doing way better. Like,
it was because of us, Joe. Just say it. It was, you know,
of course. Yeah.
It was because of us.
Thank you. I mean, the people are saying it. And by people, I mean me and John.
Yeah, by the three of us, exactly. And the weekend. And the weekend.
Many people are saying
that. I'm just saying. People are saying.
like you've never seen. But so much more stress-free to do those impressions now. But that's a good point, is that this has been kind of a whole of racing effort to rehabilitate the sport's image and create something that, you know, not just people in the industry are proud to participate in and bet on, but also outsiders can look at as something that isn't, you know, a moral hazard or, you know, it isn't something that should be frowned upon. So, I mean, I think that point is correct, that when you do the right things around the animals, especially, good things will follow. And I think that racing finally got that memo after a long, long time. And we're going to talk to a very special guest about where we still need to go from here. But I think that is a factor for sure, is that we have, in a remarkably short time, I think, been able to turn around at least somewhat the public perception of the sport. And I think a lot of that showed in the handle numbers from 2020 and so far from 2021. So we're gonna keep knocking on wood. I'm looking for wood around me. That these numbers continue to progress and look good for the sport, because as we all know, the bettors are the engine. Before the money eventually trickles up to vultures like John Green, the bettors are what create progress and growth and development in the sport. And that's why I'm hammering these issues like the computer wagering thing, because there's still a lot of kinks to be worked out, but this is a good sign, and this is a positive thing that I honestly could not have envisioned, you know, a year ago. I thought maybe we'd pick up a couple of temporary bettors that are just, you know, trying to pass the time, but it seems like we've gotten a couple of people to stick around, and that's a big deal. And, you know, there's a lot more data, a lot more reporting to be done on that. But, you know, so far so good. We'll keep an eye on it. And before we wrap up the news, I just wanted to mention, as we've talked about it the last couple of weeks, about the push to resuscitate historical horse racing in Kentucky. Obviously a huge deal to everybody in the state and in the racing industry, that the emergency bill to legalize or re-legalize historical horse race gaming by defining paramutual wagering to include historical horse racing, which is previously run races. It passed the Kentucky State Senate late yesterday afternoon, 22-15, with one senator abstaining. I'm honestly shocked that there were 15 no votes. You know, the more I thought about this, you know, even though there is that kind of conservative pushback to new gambling and new gaming, Kentucky's racing industry is just, it's so integral to the fabric of the state. I was a little surprised that there was that much pushback. And I see a lot of people on social media really going after the people who voted no, and, you know, good for them. Like that's how democracy, that's how government works. People don't vote the way you want. You can pressure them. You can call them up, you know, don't storm any Capitol buildings, but you can you can safely and legally pressure them, vote against them, you know, raise money to beat them in an election. That's democracy in action. So, you know, keep putting the pressure on the people that you know, didn't vote to sustain Kentucky's horse racing industry in that state Senate. And it has to go to the House, the Kentucky House of Representatives now. I assume it'll pass there. I don't know the ins and outs of the Kentucky House of Representatives. I'm not that in the weeds, but I assume since the Senate greenlit it, that the House will do the same. And then it'll go to Governor Andy Beshear, who's signaled support for signing it and reinstating historical horse racing. So that's good news to everybody, all our friends in Kentucky. And, you know, it generates $2.2 billion in annual handle. And the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund's purse money cut from HHR is 0.75% of that handle, which is, you know, a pretty good amount of money. That's about $15, $16, $17 million a year. So this is something that benefits not just the racing industry, but, you know, people, low income people, education, all sorts of good programs around the state. This is something that is necessary to fund a lot of the good stuff that happens in Kentucky. And we're glad that it got passed. We'll keep an eye on it, and we'll you know, report on it as soon as it passes the House of Representatives, which we expect. So deep breaths, everybody in Kentucky. I think we're going to be in the clear soon. I'm saying we, like I'm in Kentucky. You're going to be in the clear soon, and racing, historical horse racing, will be reinstated in the state.
Yeah. And Joe, you want to talk about a grassroots movement. I know that was all the talk at this past, you know, Fezzik sale, was call your congressman, call your senator, call whoever, send emails, you know, tweet, DM, direct message, all the everything you can do to pressure them to show just how much this industry means to the state of Kentucky, the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And I mean, from farms to sales companies to agents to everyone in between, we're, you know, just hitting all the airwaves of making sure that everyone in the population of their town and their counties knew exactly who to reach out to make sure they voted. And once the votes were in, that got even more play, I think, on the internet, as far as these are the ones who voted for, and can you believe it? These are the, you know, ones that voted against. And just like you said, there's going to be, you know, I don't know if there's going to be, you know, a rally or anything like that, but come next election period, the ones who didn't vote for this better have good reasons why, because they're, you know, they're going to get, they're in a heap of trouble right now.
Yeah. And I'm scared of the Family Foundation is not going to be a good enough excuse in the next election. But we've seen this before. We saw, I mean, it didn't have the kind of direct effect that I think this had, but we saw in California when they were protesting to open up the track, you know, I public pressure is so important. And especially when people take votes like this, that take, you know, I think there's going to be a big vote coming in Congress in the next week or so that I think is going to stain a lot of people's legacies going forward, and that they're going to have to explain to people, you know, in the upcoming months and years. And you know, when it's something as crucial as this is to Kentucky racing, I think having people on the record as voting against it, I think, you know, it gives a lot of power to the people of Kentucky and to the people in this industry, that they can point to this and say, look, you voted to basically deteriorate the racing industry in a sport that is basically about horses and about horse racing. So now we're going to hold you accountable. There's nothing wrong with that. That's America, baby. And you know, I'm glad that this looks like it's going to be sorted out. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is a guy that we've been trying to get on for a while. He's what you call a big get. He's the CEO of the United States Anti-Doping Agency, also known as USADA. Travis Tiger, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate the invitation to be here.
Absolutely. So we've been trying to get you on because USADA is going to be in charge of drug enforcement in our beloved sport, which sorely, sorely needs some drug enforcement. And obviously you're famous for busting Lance Armstrong as the head of USADA. And, you know, you're known as a no-nonsense guy, former lawyer. So I'm going to ask you just a basic question off the top, and then we'll get into a little bit of the details of what your role will be. How much do you know about horse racing? How much do you know to begin with? How much have you learned? What are you looking to learn?
It's usually the first question I get from horse folks. But, you know, listen, I grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, and pretty close to Ocala, Florida. I think I told the roundtable a few years ago, my high school basketball team had a chance to go to Lexington and go out and see some of the farms on that trip. So it was always something that was, you know, from a sport and a beauty and an amazing, you know, animals who compete at the highest levels is always something that, you know, to me personally, I was interested in. Obviously, at USADA, we don't currently aren't involved with the day-to-day equine world necessarily, although on our equestrian side, we do have some interaction with it. But, you know, cheating and honesty and ethics and the rule of sport are the same across all sports. So while some might want to say there's a difference between equine anti-doping and medication control programs and what happens in humans, you know, the mentality of cheating and trying to get away and get an advantage against the rules is all the same. So we're really looking forward, and it's obviously a huge responsibility, but one that we're fully ready to embrace to learn the nuts and bolts of the industry that we don't know and put in a gold standard program that people in the industry can have a lot of satisfaction and pride that it's being done at the highest levels with, you know, an equal opportunity to win playing by the rules, which is all any athlete, whether you're a trainer owner of a horse or a human athlete, that's all you can ask for.
Travis, it's Bill Finley, and thanks for joining us. And it's probably going to be a two-part question. So John, if you bear with me for just a second. So obviously you're brought in because people believe that USADA will do a better job policing the sport than the current setup with horse racing commissions. So take that and run with it. Why will USADA, in your opinion, be better than the current system that we have?
Yeah, listen, I hate the sort of who's better, who's worse, but look, the reality is, we first saw this, you know, close up, referenced the 2012 Jockey Club Roundtable that I was invited to speak at and really started looking at the policies around anti-doping and medication control within the industries. And look, they were completely antiquated. They were years behind what the human world, as well as the equine and thoroughbred horse racing industry around the world had done as far as uniform policy. So not 38 different racing districts run by state, you know, frequently conflicted people that had an interest in the outcome without transparency, without good quality testing, without laboratory accreditation that was uniform. And so it was a myriad of different rules and regulations. It actually reminded me, and I drew the comparison to what the Olympic world looked like prior to us coming into existence here in the United States in October of 2000. We just had our 20-year anniversary. So the fact that it's going to be uniform and that you can have confidence that when a horse runs in California, it's going to be, you know, running under the same rules and allowances and free of drugs in Kentucky and in New York. You know, the idea that this sport is not across state lines anymore is just, you know, it's kind of silly, frankly. And so having that uniform policy is going to be a game changer, I think, right out of the gate, regardless of who's running it. But then you look at the program and the expertise that we're going to bring from not just a testing standpoint. And I think what's really important as we begin the education with the industry on this, and always get the question, well, how's the testing going to be different? Just to look at testing is, again, an antiquated old way of looking at modern anti-doping and how you professionalize and ensure that the athlete's rights and their health and safety are going to be protected. It has to start with education, and that's going to be uniform education about the rules across the country. It's going to have research involved to ensure that things that might not be tested for today in a, you know, robust way can be tested for, and any new drugs that are coming out that would tempt trainers or owners to give their horses, for example, are going to also be able to be detected. But then you also have to have a results management process, because we know the science is limited. I mean, it's limited by the money that goes into it, the innovation that can be created. And it's a complex matrix looking at some of these drugs, some that are endogenous or natural to a human body or a horse body. So distinguishing what's synthetic versus what's endogenous is sometimes a difficult thing. And you have to get that right from a scientific standpoint. But that means you have to also have an investigative and an intelligence gathering model. And we have a whistleblower line. And look, we're the first to say it takes a team to be successful. So make the call. Last year in our human world, we had close to 500 tips to our whistleblower line. And we have a robust internal process where we investigate each and every one of those. And quite honestly, when we direct tests off of that information, we have a close to 22% positivity return, clearly indicating that when the information comes in, it's handled appropriately, it leads to the detection. And that ultimately feeds what we're ultimately after, which is the deterrence. We don't want people to cheat. But if it's too easy to get away with and there's no consequence if you get caught, then people will take advantage of that. And that's what we have to stop. And I think plugging those holes and putting in that type of program is, I think, going to do wonders to really ensure that people actually play by the rules and aren't trying to take the risk. But also knowing if you take the risk and you try to cheat, you're going to get caught and you're going to get a sanction And that's the way the rules should work, to protect those who are playing by the rules.
Thanks, Travis. And now for my follow-up question. About 1 year ago at this time, we saw the single most significant development in the history of horse racing when it comes to catching the bad guys, which was the indictments against the 27 people, including some very prominent trainers. And what we learned from that was that the FBI didn't just rely on drug testing. They relied on old-fashioned FBI police work, including wiretaps and things like that. And that's something racing commissions don't have, to the best of my knowledge, don't have the ability or the legal right to do. Can you guys go above and beyond drug testing and use such things as wiretapping people's phones to try to catch some people?
Yeah, I mean, as I just mentioned about our whistleblower line, I mean, we're a private organization, so we're not a government law enforcement. That said, we work very, very closely with law enforcement. In fact, that very case that you referenced, that started with a tip that we got in an investigation we did into a cyclist who was actually obtaining, he tested positive. He was obtaining his drugs from one of the distributors that was ultimately indicted. And that was information that we developed and handed to the FBI to say, look, we don't have jurisdiction over horse racing, but the evidence we obtained in our investigation of this cyclist who tested positive and got a sanction clearly reveals that the drugs are also being given to trainers in thoroughbred horse racing. And so we sort of pack it, we call it the Tiffany's box. We package it up and do what we can do within the bounds of our authority and our law, package it up. And then with our wonderful working relationships with, you know, FBI across the country, border control, HSI, you know, bringing things in and out of the country, other DEA, other law, FDA, other law enforcement agencies, where these are crimes that we don't police or have jurisdiction over because we deal with sport rules and sport violations, but we're going to work very closely where it's appropriate and the evidence suggests that it should be and hand them that Tiffany's box and be the advocates for the victims, those who are getting robbed in sport to say, hey, you've got to go after and enforce the laws. You got to remember sometimes, unfortunately, you know, the type of corruption and fraud you saw in that case obviously rose to a high level, but some of it is so, you know, while it has a major impact on sport, the federal government is not interested because they have a priority list that is terrorism and, you know, all the other things that they investigate and enforce that are bigger priorities than, you know, if a trainer gave a horse, you know, a drug. And so having that partnership of a private organization whose job it is to protect the playing field from a private sport rule enforcement standpoint, but being able to be the advocate to when you know, federal or other state laws have been violated to advocate for the enforcement of those laws. It's a wonderful two-pronged approach partnership that works extremely well.
And Travis, you know, it's a breath of fresh air hearing everything you're saying. And I know that we were so excited, you know, the three of us on the podcast, but also all of us who are in the industry, were so enthusiastic and excited to see you come in and try to clean up the industry and the sport that we love. You know, the industry, we're in this because it's for love of the animal, love of the sport, love of the competition. And to be on an even playing field now with you know, all the trainers have a chance, all the owners have a chance, and now it's based on your skill level and not your ability to be a chemist. So thank you for taking this on. My first question to you is, does your jurisdiction strictly in racing, or does it also, does the umbrella also cover the breeding industry and the sales industries as well?
Yeah, so, well, thanks for the kind words. And look, it's a huge responsibility. We're honored to be part of it. We feel like it's a tremendous privilege. We recognize that we're going to have to work every day and every night to prove that we're the right organization for this. You know, we're here to, and look, it's a risk to us as well, but we're willing to embrace that risk because we think it does create opportunities for greatness where the rules matter and you can win by playing by the rules. And that's what we're really passionate about. And so thank you for those comments. And I hope, and trust, I promise you, we're going to work hard to fulfill that hope that you have and recognize what a tremendous, you know, responsibility that it is. You know, listen, I think our willingness to you know, dive in and roll our sleeves up is going to be what makes the difference. And I would hope that, you know, people in the industry, you know, rise to the opportunity to be able to play, you know, play by the rules and want to win the right way is what we're after. And hopefully, as I mentioned earlier about the deterrence effect that, you know, I think necessarily you're going to see detection at some level, but the hope is, hey, the rules have changed and the enforcement has changed. And so our to be, you know, answer your specific question, our jurisdiction under the law, and this will have to be ultimately, you know, by contract, you know, defined with the authority and us, because I think, as you probably know, under the law, it creates an authority, which we don't have anything to do with. It's an independent group of people. Their jurisdiction is both anti-doping and medication control, as well as racetrack safety. And so our role is on anti-doping and medication control, and it does cover, you know, covered horses as well as covered people, which would include breeders and trainers. So if we see or have evidence of whether a positive test or other information of an owner who is covered doping a horse for purposes of selling it at, you know, an auction, even if they're done racing, you know, until that horse is retired, then yeah, that's a violation that ultimately would be enforced.
I wanted to ask about the moral side of trying to bust cheaters and dopers. You know, with the Lance Armstrong thing, I think that resonated with so many people because he was a hero to a lot of people. He was an icon, and to expose that kind of cheating, I think, you know, I think it showed everybody kind of the seedy, immoral side of sports. In racing, I feel like it's even more important to bust these guys because horses die. Horses break down and die because of drugs. Can you speak to that and speak to what kind of motivation you guys have on to not just, you know, on the legality question, but on the morality question of how important that is to clean up the sport?
Yeah. Well, you know, listen, I just think it's wrong to cheat and steal from someone else, right? Like that used to be a principle, whether there was a law about it or not, that used to be a principle our country and our citizens embraced pretty freely. We seem to have thrown some of that out the window. And look, what I do appreciate, because I've sat down with, you know, a Lance Armstrong, a Tyler Hamilton, a Marion Jones, and I've heard the pressures that are on those athletes to win. And I hear the hyper-competitive environment and the win-at-all-cost mentality. And so there is a culture in our society, and we should be honest about it, that it's okay to win even if you cheat, as long as you don't get caught. And I think a lot of people approach life in that way. And that is, from our standpoint, is simply wrong. However, in sport, the rules are very clear. And so we can land just on the rules. And our justification is the rules say you can't do that. If society wants to change the rules and say it's a free for all and you can dope and cheat and do whatever you can to win and nobody cares about it, then that's okay. I mean, I don't like it, but we'll go find new jobs and life will go on. But as long as society has said no, rules matter, and as long as sport has said rules matter, then we ought to enforce those rules to ensure that they fulfill the promise that they give to people who are abiding by the rules. What's the worst case is you're abiding by the rules with the good faith understanding that everyone else is also abiding by the rules, but you end up losing, getting robbed, getting cheated, because the people who also have agreed to the rules are secretly breaking the rules behind your back to get an advantage. And that's where our frustration comes in for the victims of this, which are the athletes. And look, I think in horse racing, as you pointed out, is it's even that much more important because the horses don't have a choice. They can't say no. You know, we saw Russia state-sponsored doping where, look, those athletes, they didn't have much of a choice. They were soldiers of the state. And they were told to go out and dope and go win. And that's what they did. In the Lance Armstrong cycling generation, look, a lot of the clean athletes got kicked out of the sport. And they really didn't have a choice. You either cheat and get a contract or you lose. And if you lose, you're not getting a contract. So they literally were kicked out of the sport. But in horse racing, so to some extent, they still had a choice. But in horse racing, the athletes don't have a choice. They're at the whims of, you know, a trainer or an owner. And that's even a more unfair situation if you look at it from, you know, a free choice to abide by the rule or not abide by the rule.
Travis, if you think about the history of what you're talking about, I would imagine they were cheating in the first ever Olympics thousands of years ago. And the incentive to cheat is built into society, especially when there's a lot of money on the line. I mean, the horse Maximum Security, which is the most famous horse trained by Jason Service, who was one of the ones that was involved in the indictments, was running in $1 million horse races. So keeping that in mind, what is the goal? What is practical? Can you actually wipe out all cheating, or can you just do the best possible job that you can possibly do, knowing that at the end of the day, despite USADA, despite everything else, there's still going to be some people who are going to try to take an edge.
Yeah, we it's a great question. We have no choice but to fight as if we're going to win it. And one athlete who gets robbed by another, who intentionally breaks the rules and gains a material advantage by using these drugs to beat them, it is an injustice we can't stand by and watch or be comfortable with. We have to stop that. And that's what motivates us every day to fight as hard as we do to protect the victim, the person that gets robbed, to protect their right. I think what we saw in cycling today in cycling, athletes have hope and they can win. Where a generation ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago during the height of the Postal Service's victories, look, I don't think you could have won even a single stage if you weren't part of the corrupt doping culture. So I think significant victories and change of culture, the bias should be in favor of those playing by the rules, and you should have a fair opportunity to win without breaking the rules. And that's what we strive for each and every day.
So Travis, what can we do? What can this podcast do? What can we do as owners and breeders in the industry to try to make it a more, even playing field and to try to help USADA make it so it is a fair industry and a fair game?
Yeah, listen, obviously the input on, and let me be really clear, this is not going to be successful. I mean, I said it earlier, it literally takes a team. It's not going to be successful if it's just, a top down, here are the rules and, we're going to hammer anybody that crosses the line. It has to be a community of people who say, you know what, this is important and this is right. And we're going to, embrace this by giving input on what the rules should be, by being willing to, as I mentioned earlier, pick up the phone and call us, the 500 tips on our human Olympic side last year, but also supporting the clean sport and abiding by those rules and saying, hey, it's not acceptable anymore to do X, Y, and Z because it's clearly in violation of the rules, and really embracing that. It has to be an organic community-led, deterrent and program that allows for a clean sport to thrive. It's not going to be us alone that does it, and we recognize that. And that's why, in part with our cycling investigation, our Nike Oregon project investigation that recently has come down, we've worked extremely hard to build relationships and have the trust of the community. The worst thing is if you're actually trying to abide by the rules is that you don't believe that the people who are supposed to be enforcing the rules actually are enforcing it in a fair way, that they have your back, so to speak. And so we work really hard to gain that confidence and gain that trust, but we simply can't do it alone. So any support, within the trenches and within the industry, picking up the phone when you see something that might be questionable, letting our review process work its way through. Those are the types of things that are going to need to happen to make it successful. And listen, that didn't happen right out of the gate when we came into the Olympic world. It took several years for people to gain that trust. And now, the 500 calls to our tip line, I think, is a great example where people are picking up the phone and calling because they want their right to clean competition to be enforced and upheld.
And what information would you need from somebody when they're calling in a tip? It can't just be, hey, I saw this trainer and his horse, won by 20 lengths. He's obviously doping. What tangible information do you need?
Yeah, well, listen, certainly performance data is part of our analysis too. And, you know, I've mentioned sometimes the Justin Gatlin case, for example. Justin Gatlin, one of the best sprinters in the world back in, I think it was 07, set a world record in the 100 meter dash in May of that. Yeah, it may have been 06, May of that year. And, you know, our team monitors that type of performance because anybody that knows sprinting knows you don't peak in May and set a world record. You wait until the Olympic Games or the World Championships, which are in August of that year. And so that kind of information will be information that we closely follow because it is important information from a testing standpoint. And if we're going to target test or in our out of competition testing, that type of common sense things like, wow, that doesn't happen unless something really unusual happened. So we don't throw out our common sense, but it can be anything, quite honestly. And I would say if you have a question, just call. And I'd rather it waste our time vetting it and it not turn out to be anything versus not making the call and it ends up turning into something later that is really, you know, detrimental and could have been stopped years earlier or never gets stopped to begin with. So I always tell people just defer and call, pick up the phone and call. And look, we have, and it's incumbent upon us, as we know in our Olympic world, and it'll be the same in the equine world, is to have a robust internal process that, you know, it's not somebody calling because they're a sore loser and they got beat, right? And then us doing something based on that. We have professional investigators, you know, former police officers, DEA agents, federal law enforcement that vet that, lawyers that are well-versed in these issues. And we take appropriate action based on the type of information that comes in.
John's a pretty sore loser, so I can't guarantee that he won't call you up complaining.
We've seen it, you know, we've seen it. Well, and look, you know, nobody likes to lose, right? Like we're all very, very competitive as sports should be. But what we hate more than anything is losing to someone that cheats us.
Of course. Yeah, no. So this is my last question. You've been very generous with your time. You must have faced, I assume, you faced a lot of institutional pushback from the sport of cycling when, you know, you're trying to take down its biggest star. I think the situation is a little different in racing, largely because of the indictments last year. I think there are a lot of people in racing who are open to this kind of change and this kind of enforcement. You mentioned that you've had some conversation with some horse people. What is the vibe that you've gotten from them in terms of welcoming you and USADA to come get involved?
Yeah. Well, one thing, you know, I understand how sometimes it gets characterized as trying to take down someone. That's not how we look at it, right? Like we want to exonerate, and we work just as hard to exonerate the innocent as we do to hold those who have broken the rules accountable. And so while I understand we held Lance Armstrong accountable, and we would have been just as satisfied, if not more, if we would have proven that he did it the right way.
I wasn't suggesting that you had like a vendetta.
Yeah, but just so people understand, I mean, that's not how we approach this intellectually. We approach it literally as, you know, exonerating the innocent or holding those accountable who broke the rules, whose decision themselves made them break the rules, and they should be held accountable. Listen, I think the industry, as I said earlier, we were invited. We were then invited by The Hill based on some industry people talking to The Hill. We've had a lot of interaction over the last 8+ years with wonderful people in the industry, trainers, owners, breeders, all sides of it, who have asked really tough questions and really good questions, who have embraced the effort. I think it's been, you know, their constant effort, the obvious deaths out in California, and then the indictments that I think created this perfect storm that finally got, you know, loosened some of the entrenched positions and said, we're going to do this. And so I think we feel very good that the industry wants this to happen. For the most part, there'll obviously be those who like the status quo because it's been very profitable for them, but you know, they're eventually going to either be weeded out or to change their behavior. And they'll be given a fair opportunity. I mentioned education earlier, but the education is key to, you know, not sending lambs to the slaughter. The rules will change. and the enforcement's going to change, but you'll be given adequate time to change behavior in order to comply with those new rules and prove that you can win the right way.
Listen, Travis, I got to say this. Everything you're saying right now is music to our ears. And this is something, it's something like, you know, we do this podcast every week and we talk about these issues. We talk about drugs. We talk about horse safety. And it just sometimes feels like, you know, hitting your head against a wall because nothing, you know, nothing changes and you rarely ever get the ear of someone who's in a position to make something change. So we can't thank you enough for coming on. And
well, guys, thanks for having me. Yeah, I really appreciate it. Yeah. Now, listen, I mean, those are our goals. It's going to take a lot of hard work and obviously the funding, but we're ready to go. And we're going to bust it to get there and hopefully fulfill the hopes and promise that we're making.
And we certainly appreciate it. And we would love, you know, down the line somewhere to have you back on and talk about the progress.
Yeah, you bet. No, for sure. As this continues to develop, let's for sure do that. We'll be, you know, a whole nother layer of sort of the rules and the procedures and, you know, the test distribution plan, the lab accreditation, all that sort of stuff that I think hopefully people will find interesting, but also see and be able to really contrast the before and after and see what a difference
going to make. Absolutely. Yeah. That's what we're hoping
for. Guys.
So,
yeah, we appreciate it. Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
Y'all take care.
Please get them.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Travis Tiger will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select supports Keeneland's efforts to give back to the thoroughbred industry. Find out more at KeenelandSelect.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, The Weeknd, producer Patty Wolf, associate producer Katie Ritz, and our editors Danny Cypher, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Anthony LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.